Sponsorship of the KQED live audio stream comes from Stanford Continuing Studies. This winter, join Stanford historians James Sheehan and David Kennedy for the Cold War and its legacies, exploring the global impact of this pivotal era. Learn more at continuingstudies.stanford.edu.
We can serve plants and animals, even fungi. Why not microbes? I'm Flora Lichtman, and this is Science Friday. We've all heard save the whales and save the sea turtles, but have you ever heard,
please conserve the microbes, they're dying?
Microbes make up about 99% of all species on Earth, but they're usually about 0% of conservation plans. One group of scientists is trying to change that. Plus, tuning into the stories that rocks can tell about our world.
I really do want everybody around me to see rocks as a vivid, as an animate and exciting part of the natural world as much as the trees and the wildlife and the rivers.
And giving thanks for your margarita.
Next time, just raise your glass to the bats.
After this.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The U.S. Supreme Court says it'll take up the Trump administration's effort to restrict birthright citizenship. NPR's Martin Costi reports the high court could upend more than a century's tradition of automatic citizenship for people born on U.S. soil.
On his first day back in office, President Trump signed an order withholding citizenship from babies born to non-U.S. citizens in the country illegally or on a temporary visa. The White House says such situations should not be covered by the 14th Amendment, which grants citizenship to people born in the country. Ohio State law professor Cesar Huatemoc Garcia Hernandez says it's a momentous case.
One that has ramifications that are hard to fathom, to rewrite the way in which citizenship has been conceived of for several generations.
So far, lower courts have disagreed with Trump's stance and blocked implementation of his order. Martin Costi, NPR News.
The congressional gerrymandering fight for next year's midterm elections is over for Texas. The Supreme Court is allowing the state to use its recently redrawn map that could help Republicans keep control of the House of Representatives. President Trump has suggested he could move some World Cup matches away from some Democratic-led host cities. At today's World Cup draw, the president was asked if he would follow through on his suggestion.
I will tell you, if they do have a problem, by the time we get there, we'll take care of that problem. We can solve that problem. I've proven that in D.C. and everywhere else we went, so we'll take care of that very easily.
During the ceremony at the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C., Trump was awarded a newly created FIFA Peace Prize for brokering ceasefire agreements in Central Africa, the Middle East, and Southeast Asia. The leaders of the other host countries, Canada and Mexico, were also in attendance. A new report from the Commerce Department shows inflation remains stubbornly high in September. But as NPR's Scott Horsley tells us, that's not expected to stop the Federal Reserve from cutting interest rates next week.
The Commerce Department's inflation yardstick, which is closely watched by the Fed, shows prices in September were up 2.8% from a year ago. That's a slightly larger annual increase than the previous month. But core inflation, which strips out volatile food and energy prices, was slightly lower than in August. Investors think the Fed is more concerned about weakness in the job market than rising prices right now, so policymakers are expected to lower their benchmark interest rate by another quarter percentage point next week. A survey by the University of Michigan shows consumers are feeling slightly better about the economic outlook than they were a month ago, but sentiment is still pretty gloomy compared to this time last year. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average is up nearly 160 points. You're listening to NPR News.
Live from KQED News, I'm Brian Watt. California State University East Bay just got a $50 million donation. The school announced yesterday that philanthropist Mackenzie Scott has given the largest single donation to the campus ever. Scott is a billionaire investor and philanthropist. She is the former wife of Amazon founder Jeff Bezos. San Francisco's new police chief, Derek Liu, says that growing the department's ranks will be one of his top priorities. KQED's Sidney Johnson reports.
Liu, who served the department for nearly 20 years, is stepping into the role of chief at a time when the city is struggling to recruit and retain officers.
Our officers right now, they're out there every single day. We're asking a lot of them, having to work mandatory overtime, coming in on days when they're normally off. So getting them some relief is at top of mind.
SFPD has seen an increase in applications and academy graduates this year, but is still roughly 500 officers shy of its recommended staffing level of 2,000. But violent and property crime have both decreased citywide in recent years, despite the staffing challenges, and a new academy class begins this month. I'm Sydney Johnson, KQED News.
UC Berkeley has announced that Tosh Lapoy will be the new coach of its football team after Justin Wilcox was fired. Lapoy is a former Cal defensive lineman and assistant coach who's been Oregon's defensive coordinator. In pro action, the Warriors lost to the Sixers 99-98 in a wild and wacky finish in Philly. The Sharks start a road trip in Dallas tonight, face off 5 o'clock our time. I'm Brian Watt. Thanks for listening to KQED News.
Support comes from Postman, used by 40 million developers to build APIs that help AI make smarter decisions. More at postman.com. Support for NPR comes from Bayer. Bayer is dedicated to delivering breakthroughs that save lives and feed the world using the scientific process. Learn more at sciencedelivers.com. And support comes from the listeners like you of KQED News. Sunny skies for the rest of this Bay Area Friday. Highs for the Bay in the mid-50s to low 60s. Mostly cloudy for southern Sacramento Valley. Highs of 50 to 57. 6 minutes after noon at KQED News.
This is Science Friday. I'm Flora Lichtman. Later in the hour, the interconnectedness of bats and tequila, and what we can learn when we listen to rocks. But first, a team of scientists is trying to jumpstart a global conservation movement on par with saving the rainforests or protecting the oceans. Actually, it might even be more ambitious because the target of their quest is invisible, everywhere, and mostly something we try to hand sanitize away. These scientists are trying to save the microbes. Leading the effort is microbial ecologist Dr. Jack Gilbert from the Scripps Institution of Oceanography. He's the co-lead of the newly formed Microbial Conservation Specialist Group under the IUCN, the International Union for Conservation of Nature. Jack, welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks, Laura. Great to be here.
Okay, why this quest?
Microbes have been around on this planet for 4 billion years. They're the epicenter of all microbial, of all diversity on the planet. They make the biggest impact. They have the key role of driving all of the climate action on the planet. All of the gases, all of the nutrients go through them. They're also the biggest biomass, right? They outweigh everything that you can see with your eyes. So we figured that they might be important for that reason.
That they deserve a seat at the table.
They deserve a seat, right? And conservation's done a great job over the last 150 years of making sure that the animals and plants have a protected status. So we wanted to put microbes in that same category. But we also think those microbes can play a fundamental role in improving the conservation strategies for animals and plants as well.
I mean, is that why you care, Jack?
No, I care because I love microbes and I'm a bit of a microbe nut, right? You know, the very first thing I ever wanted to do was culture things and grow them and see them and play with them. I mean, to me, that's my playground. They're really cool and the diversity and their functional ability and their adaptability is just so mind-blowingly awesome that it makes me excited to be able to investigate and strategize and explore that world and then leverage it to make sure the planet stays safe.
Are we tracking the loss of microbial species?
We are not. There is no current red list strategy. For some fungi, there are, but for the vast majority of bacteria, archaea, viruses, absolutely not. And we think that's a problem.
How do we know that we're losing species? How do we know that this is a problem if we're not tracking it?
Yeah, this is the very difficult question. It's very hard for us to do a full survey. When you're talking about bacteria and archaea, you have probably close to 100 billion species. Maybe a trillion strains of these organisms, subspecies level, and they are everywhere and invisible, as you say. So tracking their impact is extremely hard. We have to do it by proxy and see what's actually happening in the world. So, for example, it's quite obvious that the vast majority of microbes that might be super evolved to live inside a particular species will go extinct should that species go extinct. So think, you know, the microbes living inside an otter species or a panda, right? They will go extinct when that animal goes extinct. So that's a problem, right? But we're finding that certain species might be starting to disappear because their environment's changing. So, for example, really important species like phototrophs living in the ocean. These are like cyanobacteria that produce all the oxygen on our planet. They appear to be disappearing because the oceans are getting warmer and they can no longer survive or thrive or adapt in that system. So one of the great examples that we know is a big problem for humanity is the reduction in the biodiversity of a species called Bifidobacterium longum infantis. This is a species that lives inside our bodies, especially when we're infants, and is uniquely evolved to degrade and ferment all of the breast milk sugars that are present in human breast milk. This food that feeds our babies and makes our babies' immune systems become incredibly strong is entirely dependent upon the ability of this species to ferment it into other products which our baby's body needs as it's developing and growing. So this species is disappearing in the developing world. We've barely find it existent at all in the United States, in China now, in Europe. It's disappearing. So if we can't conserve the biodiversity of Bifidobacterium and use it to add it back into children's lives, then we're going to have chronic diseases that spread throughout our populations and make our lives a lot worse.
That's shocking because, of course, there's no shortage of humans and human babies, you know?
Right. You know, we think it's intergenerational use of antibiotics, changes in feeding habits, even changes in how we live our lives. We don't tend to coexist in family units with our grandparents and our grandchildren living side by side now. And that, we believe, is reducing the transmission of this species.
Huh. Well, what are the other threats to microbes?
So the threats to microbes are exactly the same threats that we see to all other species. Deforestation, pollution, runaway climate change, changes in weather patterns, agricultural activity. All of the practices which damage our natural environment are also damaging the microbes. But when we eradicate the microbes, our ability to restore those ecosystems is severely impeded. So think about mangrove swamps. When you wipe out a mangrove swamp, you can't just replant the trees and expect them to be able to grow. First, you have to rehabilitate the soils and the sediments those trees grow in by adding bacteria back into that environment. Then the trees can survive.
I mean, habitat loss, you know, urbanization, climate change, these are the usual suspects in so many biodiversity loss, you know, problems. Why do microbes need their own protections? Can't we just, like, do the things that we've been trying to do for macrofauna or plants?
Yeah, so, you know, I call them macrobes, everything that's large and not a microbe, right?
Macrobes, I love it. Yes, of course, because it's our macro bias that we would call them microbes at all.
Exactly. So one thing one of my colleagues once said was if we'd had conservation of microbiology and the integration of microbiology into the conservation strategies that we've been playing with the last 150 years, we might be a lot further ahead in being able to conserve and preserve the microbes around the world.
Okay, so what do you do differently for microbes that you don't do for macrobes? How does the strategy change?
So it's interesting, you know, we've been exploring strategies such as putting a fence around a forest, even preserving the embryos and eggs and sperm of these animals and plants in frozen banks, right? Frozen zoos. And you can think about the seed bank up in Svalbard as a great example of that. We're doing the same thing for microbes. We've started a microbiota vault that allows all of the world's microbial collections to be preserved in another environment, right? That means that we can use them later on.
Okay, so a microbe vault. Are there other strategies? Give me another example of how microbe conservation would work.
So a great example of how microbe conservation would work would be ensuring that we understand where microbes are under threat, and that we put in place strategies to facilitate their conservation. A great example of that is desert soil crusts. These are living environments that you can't see with your eyes, but they actually stop all the dust in deserts from blowing up into the atmosphere. And they form these biofilms that live on the surface of these deserts, and they stop all the dust and dirt from getting into the atmosphere. These desert soil crusts are under threat. They're not seen by humans to be important, so people tread on them, they crush them, they develop on them, and they are being destroyed by runaway climate change. So we need to conserve those environments.
Jack, last time we talked, you were swabbing toilet seats in the name of your love of microbes. Are you still just swabbing everywhere you go?
Hey, you got to, if you don't swab somewhere, you don't know what you're missing, man. That's really important. Yeah, we you know, and part of this conservation management strategy is to go out into environments and track down what we don't know, right? What you can see with your eyes or the plants and animals are just the tip of the iceberg.
How does this play at conservation conferences? Like, how do your colleagues view your work?
It's taken a little while for us to convince even some of the conservation teams that microbiology could be an important part. Even other microbiologists are telling us that, well, you know, you don't really need to conserve microbiology because it evolves so quickly. You know, they have very short generation times. They can adapt. They've adapted to every single one of the major extinction events. My point
is that wrong?
Well, it isn't, but my point is so have the other animals and plants. If you wiped out all of the rhinos on the planet, in another 100,000 years or a million years, something would evolve to fit that niche. The same is true for microbiology, just on a shorter time scale. And so, you know, what matters in conservation is why something is important to people in order to conserve. If it's not important to a human, why are we bothering to conserve it? You know, us. It's a bad way of saying it, isn't it? Makes us sound a bit dystopian.
I think your love goes a long way, Jack. I think people underestimate, you know, other people's love of things as a motivator.
E.O. Wilson once said that, you know, the reason biology was important to people is because they fell in love with it. He called it biophilia. And I think the same has to be true for microbiology, microbiophilia, if you will. But the idea is that we conserve something because it means something to humanity, whether that's because it provides an ecosystem service, like pumping oxygen into the atmosphere, or whether it's because it can make our soils more fertile and therefore produce more food to keep our population safe. These are important components of why microbiology could drive forward a new revolution in making this planet more sustainable and supportive for humanity and for the rest of biodiversity. But it all starts with the microbes.
Yeah, I also think that scientists underuse the heartstrings. I'll just say that.
Yeah. Please conserve the microbes. They're dying.
I think you need a panda, a microbe panda of this movement, like the face, the charismatic mini fauna that people are going to fall in love with. What should it be?
My favorite bug is Fecalibacterium prinzii. This is an amazing organism that lives inside the guts of us and other species and plays a vital role in our health. There's also brilliant species in the soil. I mean, this is impossible to choose from my own children. You can't ask me to do a Sophie's choice on which one's more important, right? Microbes are just incredible, and the diversity is just so vast and unbelievably important.
Dr. Jack Gilbert is a microbial ecologist at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography in San Diego. He's also a co-chair of the IUCN's Microbial Conservation Specialist Group. Jack, thank you for joining me today.
Thanks, Laura.
Coming up after the break, we raise a glass to Mexico's bats. This is Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
Support for KQED comes from the historic San Jose Civic, presenting Dave Cause and Friends Christmas Tour with special guests Jonathan Butler, Haley Reinhart, Casey Abrams, and Kayla Waters live on December 21st. Tickets available now at sanjosecivic.com. And support comes from visitorscoverage.com, a marketplace for travel insurance. Now, helping travelers find the right coverage for domestic or international trips, including cancellations, delays, and medical emergencies. Learn more at visitorscoverage.com. Michael stayed in for Sandy Althaus. Check Please Bay Area, celebrating 20 years of Bay Area food, culture, and community. Watch this special anniversary season as local diners share their favorite Bay Area restaurants. Catch Check Please Bay Area Thursdays on KQED 9 or stream the program anytime at kqed.org/checkplease.
This is Science Friday. I am Ira Plato. As you enjoy your holiday libations, some of your favorite drinks, like those margaritas, may be connected, oddly enough, to an animal you would have never guessed. Bats. Okay, let me explain. When you think about bats, chances are you think of the ones you see at dusk flitting about to hunt insects, right? But some species of bats like to eat fruits or flowers, not bugs, and they play an important role as pollinators. Now, one place that the pollinator role is crucial is in the relationship between bats and agave plants. And that has consequences both for the ecosystems around the agave and for your liquor cabinet, since agave is the source of drinks like tequila and mezcal. Now you get it, right? Well, here to explain this seemingly strange connection is Dr. Kristen Lear, director of the Agave Restoration Initiative at Bat Conservation International. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. What kind of bats are we talking about here?
So there's three species of nectar-feeding bats that we're talking about that migrate between Mexico and the U.S. and that feed on the nectar of agave plants. Unfortunately, one of them is endangered, the endangered Mexican long-nosed bat, and that's why we're working to protect them.
All right, so explain to me the connection between the bats and the agave.
Yeah, so these bats, the three species, are migratory. They mate in central Mexico, and then the pregnant females, while they are pregnant, they undergo a long distance, over 700-mile migration northward up to northern Mexico and the U.S. southwest. And along that route, they're feeding on these beautiful blooming agave plants that have these nectar-filled flowers that provide the fuel for this migration. And then once those pregnant mothers reach northern Mexico and the U.S., in some areas, it is only agave plants that are available and providing nectar for these bats and for these mothers to sustain them and help them feed their babies.
Yeah, and so I guess it's critical for the survival of the plants then, too.
Yeah, yeah. These bats are, as they're feeding from the agave flowers, they're kind of these clumsy flyers when they go up to the agave flowers, and they kind of clumsily fall onto the flowers, and they get covered in pollen. And then they spread that pollen over miles between different agave plants. These bats can fly 50 kilometers or more one way from a roost at night to go feed and then go back to their roost. So they're really spreading that agave pollen across those different agave populations and really helping maintain the genetic diversity of those plants.
I would have never thunk that a bat is a pollinator.
They're kind of the overlooked pollinator, you know, because they're out at night. We get to see butterflies and bees and hummingbirds, you know, during the day. But these bats are kind of this mysterious, unknown pollinator just because they're out at night and we don't get to see them.
So can the agaves reproduce without the bats?
Some agave species also reproduce asexually. So through rhizomes, for example, under the ground, they have these little pups or baby agaves that grow out from the mother plant. But some species of agaves only reproduce sexually through pollination and seed production. So you have a mix, and even for the ones, the agaves that can clone themselves or reproduce with pups, if you're a clone, you're genetically identical to the mother plant. So if you clone too much over time, that population of agaves is too genetically similar and bad things can happen. Pest outbreaks, disease outbreaks can come through and wipe out that agave population because there's no genetic diversity to protect them.
So as we're drinking our tequila drinks, we should know that without flowering agave, we would have no tequila or mezcal?
Correct. Yep, these bats and these agaves have evolved together, and without those bats, we would not have those lovely products that we so enjoy.
We should hoist one, right, while we're drinking and
we should
toast the bats.
We definitely should.
I'm going to remember that. So you want to be nice then to your agave plants. Mm-hmm. What are the threats? What is threatening their lives?
Yeah, so you know, you just mentioned harvest of agaves for liquor like tequila, mezcal, bacanora. That can be done unsustainably or sustainably. So, you know, depending on how it's done, can either support bats or not support bats. But beyond, you know, direct harvest of agaves, there are other big threats to agaves like grazing. Cattle love to eat the growing stalks of the agaves because they're really full of sugar and they're really kind of a treat for the cattle. So in places that have kind of this unsustainable grazing, these cattle are eating the agaves. And they're also kind of getting rid of the natural native grasses that sustain agave populations. So grazing, land use change in general, expansion of agriculture, and then drought. Drought is a big thing that's impacting a lot of ecosystems, including agaves. Agaves are pretty drought tolerant, but, you know, when you have extreme drought for extended periods of time, that's leading to losses of agaves and leading to things like wildfires that also.
Wow. Climate change.
Yeah. It's all tied. It's all exacerbated by that.
I know that you're trying to help the bats by restoring the agave, but beside the relationship with bats, why is agave so important?
So at Bat Conservation International, we're working to restore these agave plants through the Agave Restoration Initiative. Of course, our angle is the bat angle, right? We want to save these bats. But agaves are so important economically, right, for tequila, mezcal, bacanora, all these products that we get, agave syrup that we can buy at the grocery store. They're this really important economic product, but they're also culturally important in many communities in Mexico and in the U.S. They support erosion control. So if you plant an agave, their root systems help sustain the soil and help maintain healthy lands and healthy soils. There's many other uses, medicinal uses for agaves, cattle fodder. You know, you can chop up agaves and feed them to your cattle and goats, especially in times of drought when there's no natural, you know, grass fodder out there. So, you know, all of these reasons are reasons that people want to protect and restore agaves besides just protecting the bats.
Okay, so give me your pitch to the people living on or near agave land for why they should protect the agaves. Is it money? Is it the environment? Or everything or all of that?
Yeah, I mean, all of it, but I really think it comes down to what's your angle? What is driving you? You know, we all come at conservation or land restoration from different angles. Say you're a person in the U.S. We work with a lot of private landowners in the U.S. or community groups. They love agaves because they're beautiful plants. They're iconic desert and grassland plants. So they want to plant and restore agaves to beautify their landscapes. That's one angle. Or if you're a cattle rancher in an ejido in Mexico, we work a lot with communities in Mexico, you want to have sustainable food, fodder for your livestock. Planting agaves and restoring the land helps you feed your livestock and maintain your livelihood. And then, you know, then there's the crazy bat nerds, the bat people who want to save the bats, right? I think we all come at it from a different angle, but we all get to the same goal.
Yeah. Speaking of saving the bats, are there things people can do to help the bats, like building bat boxes?
Yeah.
Things like that.
Yeah. So some species of bats do roost in bat boxes or bat houses. These three nectar feeding bat species do not roost in those bat boxes, but other species do. So in cases where there's habitat that's being destroyed or you're doing like an exclusion of bats from your house, that would be a great time to put up a bat house to help, you know, provide a shelter for them. But also one thing you can do anywhere you live is plant a bat garden. You can plant night blooming flowers. Agaves, of course, if you're in an agave area, you can plant agaves. But even if you're not, you can plant native night blooming flowers that open at night and attract nocturnal insects that our insectivorous bats can eat. So you have your own little kind of bat buffet, bat smorgasbord in your garden, and you're supporting bat populations by planting a bat garden.
That is cool. All right. So how has the restoration effort been going? Can you track the progress?
Yeah, it's been going great. So we have been working on the agave restoration initiative for about 7 years now, and we have planted a little over 180,000 of these agaves across that binational migratory corridor. We have over 100 partners that we work with in the U.S. and Mexico, including ejido communities, private ranchers and landowners in the U.S., tribes, government groups, NGOs, etc. We kind of run the gamut. And we're also not just planting agaves. We're restoring the land, so we're working with communities to implement sustainable grazing and management practices. We support community green business enterprises that support native habitats. And all of this together is helping to restore that binational nectar corridor.
So you're hopeful that this is working. Your effort is making a difference with all these problems.
Yes. We also monitor the roosts of these bats, you know, where they're living. And we are seeing the numbers starting to stabilize for the endangered Mexican long-nosed bat. So there is hope that what we're doing is working, and that what we're doing will continue to support these bats long into the future.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Lear. I will never look at my drink again the same way. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Absolutely. Thank you. And yeah, next time, just raise your glass to the bats.
I'll be doing that, I hope. Dr. Kristen Lear, director of the Agave Restoration Initiative, that's at Bat Conservation International. She is based in Loveland, Colorado. This is Science Friday from WNYC Studios. Turning from bats to butterflies, by now the annual fall migration of monarch butterflies is over. The eastern population has moved to central Mexico to overwinter, and the western population is camped out in coastal California. That migration can mean a flight of thousands of miles, which makes you wonder, how in the world do monarchs do that? Joining me now is science journalist Dan Fagan. He's author of a recent article in the New York Times detailing how researchers are tracking individual butterflies as they migrate. He's also director of the Science, Health, and Environmental Reporting Program at New York University. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks, Ira.
Okay, so how do you go about tracking a single butterfly?
Well, we really couldn't do it until very recently. Or I guess it would be more accurate to say that we've done it in very primitive ways for many years. It used to be that all you could do was put a sticker tag on a monarch and hope someone would find it, look at the number on it, and at least know where that monarch came from. There's now a technology that creates a radio tag that's small enough that it can actually be glued to the thorax of a monarch butterfly. And for the first time, we know not only where these journeys start and end, but we know everywhere that monarchs go in between, and it's pretty amazing.
You mean it's small enough that it doesn't load down the butterfly so it can't fly?
Well, we know that monarchs can fly with these tags. It surely affects them somewhat, but we've had tests of monarchs flying all the way from as far as Ontario, and they've been tracked all the way to Mexico. Wow. So at least some of them, a significant percentage of them, are not affected by the tags, at least not to the point where it prevents them from migrating.
Okay, so you have these little radio transmitters, right, on each of the monarch butterflies. And how do they transmit? Who picks them up?
That might be the coolest part. They're solar powered, right? So there's not a big heavy battery that the monarchs need to carry. But what's most interesting is that the information gets continuously downlinked, I guess you could say, to anyone who has a cell phone that is Bluetooth enabled. As long as your cell phone is on, you are helping to track these butterflies.
That's how those little iPhone tags work also, don't they?
Correct. It's how your Find Your Phone works. So as a result, there are literally billions of potential monitoring stations for these tags. And you can get very robust data. It's not perfect data. There are still spots that are not well covered, but there are so many Bluetooth-enabled cell phones that there are not very many of these dead spots. In fact, some of the monarchs have even been tracked over the ocean because they come close enough to a passing boat, for example.
No kidding. All right. So now that they've collected all this data, have they found anything surprising about the migrations?
Yeah. I had a good conversation with Chip Taylor, who's the founder of Monarch Watch. And Chip was very surprised by some of the things that these paths show. For one thing, monarchs get blown way, way off track. And yet, in many cases, they have the ability to right themselves and eventually head south again. And Chip, for one, was surprised by just how drastically they can get blown off of their general southwestern course. So that's one surprise. I think another one is that, you know, there's been a lot of controversy over how many of these monarchs really make it. We know that a lot of them don't. There are so many perils along the way, and it's very exhausting for them. They have strong wings, but it's a lot to ask them to fly thousands of miles. And yet, judging from these tag monarchs, we have about 400 so far that have been tracked this year. Pretty decent percentage of them make it down to the Mexican sites. So in some ways, that's good news. It suggests that more of these monarchs can survive the journey maybe than many experts thought.
I guess finally, what is the problem that these tag flights are trying to solve?
Generally speaking, the migration is this wondrous, amazing thing. And it's, you know, people have a real emotional connection to this butterfly. They've grown up with it. Its habitat is most of North America during the summer. So they love it. And yet this migration is certainly in trouble. We know from measuring the size of the Mexican colonies that there have been drastic reductions in the numbers of monarchs that make it all the way to Mexico and thus are able to continue their yearly multi-generational life cycle. So we really need to understand what's happening on these migratory paths if we want to save the migration itself, because there are serious questions, Ira, as to whether we will see migrating monarchs 20 years from now, 30 years from now.
What a shame that would be.
Yeah, it really would be. I mean, people love this butterfly, and if we want to make progress in protecting it, we need to really understand its migration much better. And until now, until this year, the paths that monarchs took were almost a complete mystery. And now we know, after a century of studying monarchs, and it's really quite amazing.
Well, thank you, Dan. This has been quite fascinating. Thank you for sharing what you found out about them.
Thanks. It was good to be with you, Ira.
Dan Fagan, science journalist and director of the Science, Health, and Environmental Reporting Program at New York University. And you'll find a link to his article on the butterfly migration all there on our website at sciencefriday.com/monarch. After the break, listening to stories about our planet's history as told by rocks. This is Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
Science Friday is supported by MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software for technical computing and model-based design. MathWorks, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. Science Friday is also supported by BetterHelp, committed to making mental well-being a priority and offering support in taking on everything life demands, with therapists available to communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public, and by Progressive Insurance. Progressive's rate comparison tool can be used to find a competitive rate on car insurance for coverage on the road. Options to fit most any budget. More at Progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE.
This week on Bay Curious.
I'm Gabriella Glick. The Nimitz House is this grand-looking house tucked underneath the Bay Bridge's eastern span. I ended up talking to someone who lived there, and it turns out that the Nimitz House is kind of a vestige of Yerba Buena Island's military history. It was the house for the top commanding officer on base. And the house has fallen into a bit of disrepair.
Listen to the new episode now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Support for KQED on Science Friday comes from the San Francisco Symphony, where listeners can join the symphony to ring in the holidays with festive concerts throughout December. Learn more about their holiday programs at sfsymphony.org/holiday. And Block Construction. Service-minded builders striving to enhance California communities, building schools, housing, and more. Block Construction, helping build futures since 1970. Info at block.com. That's BLACH.com.
If you feel like traffic has been worse, you are not imagining it. In many places, congestion has surpassed pre-pandemic levels. What we're seeing on the roads, on All Things Considered, from NPR News.
As you travel the Bay Area and southern Sacramento Valley roads this afternoon, join us for All Things Considered. 1 to 2 this afternoon, 5 p.m. to 6:30 as well, right here on KQED News. Science Friday time is 12:40.
This is Science Friday. I'm Flora Lichtman. When we commune with nature, I think most of us turn towards the living. A walk in the woods with big trees, chirping birds, blooming flowers, humming insects. But my next guest says don't overlook the inanimate. Don't sleep on rocks. Dr. Anjana Katwa is an earth scientist, but her love for rocks isn't just scientific. It's spiritual, poetic, and lyrical, which she writes about in her new book, The Whispers of Rock, the stories that stone tells about our world and our lives. Anjana, welcome to Science Friday.
Oh, thank you for having me, Flora.
I'm so excited to talk to you today to learn all the things that I, you know, have been overlooking about rocks. Where did this love story begin for you?
Oh, it began a long time ago when I was about 13 years old. I was a teenager and my parents are from Nairobi in Kenya. And whilst on a holiday there, we stopped off at this quite incredible place called the Shaitani Lava Flows, which is now in the Tsavo West National Park in southeastern Kenya. And I grew up in a town just on the outskirts of London, a place called Slough. And it's not a place where you tend to go to see nature. Let's just say that it's very, very urban. And walking across this incredible African savanna, it was covered in this jagged black rock. And when I was walking across these rocks, I didn't really understand why they were there, why they looked the way they did. But I knew that they had an incredible story to tell. Now, the interpretation signs said they were lava flows. And of course, my imagination ran riot and I could imagine seas of lava, you know, churning over this landscape. And as I walked over those rocks, they spoke to me. And on that day, my parents took a photo of all of us, you know, kind of standing by the obligatory tourist sign. But also I picked up a rock and here it is. And it's a piece of basalt.
You still have
jagged.
It.
I still have it. And, you know, I think about, you know, the passage of time, passage of deep time, obviously, but my own life, it's all recorded in this moment that I picked this rock up. I was 13 and I made the decision. I thought, oh, this is what I want to do. I want to tell stories about rocks. This is what I want to do as a job. And now I'm 50. I've written a book about it. So it's quite a journey.
You did it. You did it. I mean, you know, the thing that I love about that story is that most people go to Kenya to see these charismatic megafauna, the amazing animals, and your takeaway from Kenya was a rock.
Yeah, I've heard that a lot. When I went back 2 years ago as part of the research for the book, I went back to that place where I picked up this rock. And that was one of the key conversations I had with some of the wildlife rangers I went with. Like, you're not here to see the elephants or any of the other wildlife. I said, no. I want to see these rocks. They were very, very puzzled. That's generally the reaction that I get.
So how did you go from a 13-year-old who had this experience to doing what you do now? What was that journey like?
It was tough. I'm not going to lie. I kind of grew up in a traditional South Asian culture in the UK that where my parents just felt maybe I should choose a sensible career like working in a bank or becoming a lawyer or a doctor. And as soon as I said, you know, actually, this is what I want to study. I want to study rocks. I want to study the creation of our earth. They were very, very puzzled. And there's a movie like Bend It Like Beckham, you know, where that young Asian girl says, you know, I want to be a footballer. And the parents say to her, who's going to want to marry a girl that, you know, wants to kick a football all day? These are the kind of conversations I had with my parents. So I kind of went on to university nonetheless to study a degree in earth sciences and then a PhD at the University of Southampton.
Wait, pause for a second. Because that's actually quite difficult. If you're hearing your family or community say, why would you do this? To say, well, I still am going to do it, whether you think that's a good idea or not. Well, how did you make that decision? Sort of how did you get through that period?
That was probably the toughest part because it caused a rift in my family between me and my parents. And that rift went on for a couple of years. And I had to make a decision. I thought, well, this is actually what I want to do. This is where my heart is calling me. And my dad in particular didn't quite understand it. My mum was sympathetic. But I needed a few years away from that kind of debate about who I wanted to be. And that those few years away when I was studying my PhD, they allowed me to become the woman that I was, you know, strong, stubborn, you know, very hard-headed about what I wanted to achieve. Now, of course, they couldn't be prouder. They're so delighted with what I've done.
That's amazing. Well, transmit some of that passion to me. What do you think most people just don't get about rocks?
I think rocks, they look at objects like this and they'll walk past them every day and they won't talk to you. They won't sing a song. They won't even move for the most part because they take hundreds, if not millions of years to actually change and shape themselves, if you like. And I'm going to hold one in my hand. It's a green colored rock and the mineral that makes it green is a mineral called chlorite. It's quite hard. And on the surface of the rock, there are these chevron type ripples that kind of run across the rock. There are layers and these chevron zigzag kind of texture is because this rock marks a moment when a mountain was born. And it's called a green schist. And a green schist is a rock that's formed under intense heat and pressure. The moment it was born was when two continents began to move towards each other and collide. And in between them was an ocean called the Iapetus Ocean. At the bottom of that ocean were some muddy sediments like silts and clays. And as those two continents, and this is North America where you are, and me, well, I say Baltica, but that kind of continent which became Scandinavia in Northern Europe, those two continents were very gradually moving towards each other. They closed that ocean and the sediments at that bottom of the ocean were squashed and moved upwards to create an incredible range of mountains. Now that heat and pressure changed those muddy sediments into this rock. And so when I'm looking at these kind of beautiful chevron zigzag texture in the rock, that's the moment when that mountain was born. And I think it's when you recognize that those are the stories that the rocks hold inside them, if we can unlock them, it just gives you this immense sense of gravity of the time that passes, the immense sense of planetary processes that creates our Earth. I find it awesome, actually.
It is awesome. I mean, hearing you talk about it, I have that same feeling of awe and wonder that I feel when we talk about outer space or the universe, you know, the cosmos, but it's our own planet, which makes it sort of even more special somehow.
It does. And I mean, you can contrast it with this rock. So this one is a piece of siltstone from Boscastle in Cornwall. And what you can see in this rock, it's very grey and it's interleaved with kind of brown layers. It's very, very finely laminated. It's almost like a ream of papers that have been stacked up.
It looks like puff pastry, like brown,
yes,
like black puff pastry.
Yeah, exactly. And in contrast to the other rock that signifies immense planetary power, continents crashing together, in my hand, this signifies silence and solitude, because what this rock is, it's a rock that signifies that moment when silts and clays, which are so tiny, tiny, tiny grains of sediments, they're settling on the bottom of a seafloor and it's utterly quiet and they're able to settle in such undisturbed conditions. They're able to build very, very fine layers and those layers have eventually become this rock. So it's like holding silence in my hands.
Okay, you travel the world for this book. Tell me one of your favorite trips.
One of my favorite trips was to Petra Archaeological Site in Jordan. I think that's on a bucket list for any geologist or anybody that's interested in how people have lived in very challenging environments like deserts. Now, Petra was incredibly special because the rocks there are probably some of the most beautiful rocks I've seen in my life, actually. They are the colours of the rainbow. They're pink, orange, yellow, turquoise. And it was special for me because I could witness how the ancient Nabataeans had survived in quite a harsh landscape, but also how they had harnessed the way nature had carved a niche into the rocks so they could live and survive and prosper in that region. I just thought it was one of the most extraordinary places I'd ever been.
What did it feel like to be there?
It felt magical because when I place my hands on the rocks, I'm feeling, I'm listening to their stories. And when I look at those beautiful arcuate bands of sandstone with all the amazing colours, I can sense that it's a river literally dancing over a plain, carrying in the waters grains of sand that eventually come to rest on a riverbed or on a riffle or on a bank. And so sand grains collect, they cement together over time and they form a sandstone. And then much later, mineral-rich groundwaters filter through that rock, staining the cement, creating the beautiful spectacle that we can see in Petra. And all of this is something that I feel implicitly when I was in that environment.
Mm. You spoke with many indigenous leaders about their tribal histories with rocks. What did you learn?
I learned that science sits in a space that needs to reflect and understand and be tolerant of different belief systems. I realize that we need to come to a place of equity in how we tell stories about the way the world was created. And the more I kind of delved into the origin stories that I had the privilege to retell in this book, the more I understood how our understanding of the scientific creation of the world is very much built upon indigenous stories and myths and legends and folklore, because actually their understanding of natural processes and change over time can be charted back 10, 20, 30,000 years. And it's this building of human experience and observation upon our scientific research and understanding that makes our appreciation of how the world has come to be so much richer.
Mm. You also write about a granite peak in Yosemite, Half Dome, as some of us know it. Tell us that story.
That's perhaps one of the most magical stories that captured my heart. Half Dome, as it's known in the Awanichi language, Miwok First Nations, she's known as Tisayak, and the story goes as follows, because the Awanichi people were living in Yosemite Valley for perhaps about 6,000 years before the white settlers came. And the story is that a man and a woman were traveling through Yosemite Valley and they were hungry and thirsty and tired. The man was walking with a stick and his wife was carrying a heavy basket. And as a woman reached a lake, she drank the lake dry because she was so thirsty. And when her husband arrived, he was angry because she'd left him no water to quench his own thirst. He was so angry, he reached for his stick to strike her. And she was terrified and she ran away with tears streaming down her face. And in her own anger, she threw her basket at him. Now, the great spirit that was watching all of this debacle unfold, he became quite angered. And so he turned the both of them into stone. The man became Washington Tower, which is on one side of Yosemite Valley. And the woman, Tisayak, was turned into what we call Half Dome, this incredible granitic peak that is one of probably, I think, the most iconic features in Yosemite National Park. Now, the reason why this is such a spectacular and moving story is that even after 6,000 years, we can still feel a sense of gravitas and emotion when we look at Tisayak, because you can still see the streaks of her tears lining the face of the granite. Now, scientists know the streaks, these black streaks on the grey rock, as lichen. The fact that this story is still told in Miwok First Nations communities gives us some indication as to how slowly the rock weathers and changes. And for me, it kind of helps us to view landscapes like this through a completely different lens. Through First Nations eyes, we see it as a monument to regret and sadness and essentially to be kind to each other.
Was Half Dome forged in a moment of geologic passion? I mean, is there some continuity there?
I think there is. I think Half Dome was formed because of a plume of magma rising upwards due to the formation of the Sierra Nevada. So here you have the Farallon Plate, which is an oceanic crust subducting, so it's sinking beneath the North American Plate. And as it does so, there are big plumes of magma that rise up and intrude into the crust above. Now, they don't achieve their destiny, which is erupting through a volcanic eruption. They get trapped within the crust, and they take perhaps 2 to 3 million years to cool down these magma plumes. And over that time, they crystallize and they form granite. And I think what that teaches us, in especially in reference to the story of Tissiak, is patience, to remain calm underneath all conditions, to basically, you know, wait and see what transpires. If we can control and hold on to our emotions, beautiful things will happen.
Easier said than done.
Easier said than done.
This is Science Friday from WNYC Studios. You have an emotional connection with rocks. We can hear it in your voice. Have you faced pushback from, you know, the capital S scientific community for that?
Yes, I have. I think some people have called me romantic, and I think you can make of that what you will, because I think that in itself has lots of different meanings, whether they look at me as a woman and think I'm less of a scientist because I bring emotion into the work that I do. But I think to counter that narrative, the most important lesson of the book is that through fostering a sense of love, we can perhaps rekindle that sense of custodianship and care and ethical thinking that we need to build into our science. Because one of the key things I've been told time and time again is that the book is challenging. It's challenging because of some of the concepts it discovers and reveals to the reader, but it's also very challenging in the sense that it's putting feelings of love that I don't think scientists talk about too much. It puts that up front and center. And I think it does take courage to do that. But what I'm hearing is that I think people are pleased that I've done that, that I've been one of the first people to step forward and say, I love this. I genuinely am saying it with my chest. I love rocks, and I want other people to see that joy in the same way that I do.
Do you think you got that courage from your own personal journey, where you had to figure out what you believed in and stand up for it? And do you think you put that in your backpack for this moment too?
Yes, I think my whole background of having to challenge obstacles, to having to prove myself, not just as a woman, but as a woman of color in the science, I think it makes you slightly risk taking. You know, I have nothing to lose. I really do want everybody around me to see rocks as a vivid, as an animate and exciting part of the natural world, as much as the trees and the wildlife and the rivers. And I think by saying that with my full chest, with my full heart, I think that's how you win people over, because that honesty and that force of feeling, people can't ignore it. But all of the hardships I've had to go through have strengthened me to do that.
Dr. Anjana Katwa, earth scientist and the author of the new book, The Whispers of Rock, the stories that stone tells about our world and our lives. Thanks for joining me today.
Oh, thank you for having me, Flora. It's been an absolute joy.
Likewise. If you want to read an excerpt from the book, go to sciencefriday.com/rocks. That's sciencefriday.com/rocks. We'll see you next week. I'm Flora Lichtman.
Science Friday is supported by Progressive Insurance, presenting Progressive's Name Your Price tool, which shows customers coverage options that fit their needs. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. Support for Science Friday also comes from Seed.com. Seed DS01 is a 24-strain 2-in-1 probiotic and prebiotic engineered to survive digestion, support healthy regularity, and promote whole body health. Learn more at seed.com/public. And from StoryWorth. Each week, StoryWorth emails a loved one a question about their life. After a year, StoryWorth will publish their stories and color photos into a book to keep for generations. Learn more at StoryWorth.com.
This is Ira Glass. On This American Life, one thing we like is a good mystery. Sometimes about really big things, things you hear in the news. But most times, the little mysteries are the best.
Our lost and found is currently filled with pants. I don't know. I've never seen this happen.
Wait, this is true?
This is true.
Mysteries of every size. This American Life.
Ira Glass is the host of the program. Hear it Saturday at noon and again 7 p.m. on Saturday on KQED News. Here is Steve Herrera checking a traffic collision in Fremont. Steve?
Hello there, Michael. I'm seeing heavy traffic in Fremont northbound 680 just after Autumnall. A truck and an SUV have collided on the right shoulder. In Novato, eastbound Highway 37 at Lakeview Highway, a semi on its side on the shoulder with another vehicle involved in this one. On the upper deck of the Bay Bridge after the Yerba Buena Tunnel, some sort of a hazard taking away the right lane. Steve Herrera for KQED.
Traffic support comes from Murphy McKenna Construction Custom Home Builders. Support for KQED comes from John Muir Health, delivering cardiac surgery with a patient-first approach and minimally invasive techniques in the East Bay at John Muir Health. We look to be sunny for the Bay today. The rest of the day, highs in the mid-50s to the low 60s.